Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast. If you're looking for the most in-depth insight into the world of downhill and enduro mountain biking, then this is the podcast for you. Before we introduce this week's guest, I want to say thanks to our supporting partners who enable me to keep bringing you the podcast every week. First up, thanks to Cushcore. The response to our episode with their founder and inventor, Adam Crefton, was insane. So if you haven't listened yet, then check it out and find out why Cushcore is much more than just something to protect your rims and actually improves the performance of your bike. Cushcore is a game changer that's used by this year's EWS Men's Series leader, Martin Mays, and three times world downhill champion, Loic Bruni, along with many others. I've had them on my trail bike now for about 3 months, and I was shocked by how much difference they have made to the bike. They offer improved damping, increased cornering support, and an ability to carry more speed through the rough stuff. Head to cushcore.com and check them out. Next up is the Trailhead Bicycle Company, who are an awesome local bike shop based in Shrewsbury in the UK. Their owner, Sandy Plenty, has been on the podcast before, so make sure you check out that episode. Right from the start, their main focus was customer service, and the whole team go to great lengths to help and support their customers. So as our downtime listeners can experience that awesome customer service for themselves, the Trailhead are offering 15% off on workshop labour when you quote Trailhead15 at the time of booking. All you need to do is give them a call or an email. The offer is limited to one service per customer. You can find them over on the internet at thetrailhead.co.uk. Sandy would also like to say a massive thank you to everyone who continues to support their local bike shops by shopping local. As well as the podcast, we've got a website where you can find all the links to things which get mentioned in the episodes, be that book recommendations, other websites, specific products, all of that kind of stuff. All you need to do is head to downtimepodcast.com and find the relevant episode page. While you're there, we've got a subscribe page that will help you subscribe to the podcast and also to our newsletter. It's free and it means you'll get each episode delivered to your device as soon as it's available. Not all of our episodes are available on other websites, so if you want all of our content, then subscribing is the way to go. We've also got a web store where you can get your hands on exclusive Downtime Podcast merchandise. It's all top quality, ethically sourced, and now shipped without the use of any plastics. What's even better is that the shipping is free worldwide on orders over £30. If you want to be part of that growing club, then head to downtimepodcast.com/shop. If you're enjoying the podcast, then please leave us a review and tell your friends. It's you guys that spread the word and help the podcast grow, and I really appreciate your support. Okay, it's time for this week's guest. With 5 elite world championships and 6 World Cup overall wins, Rachel Atherton has been at the very top of the sport for a long time now. We sit down for a chat about how it all began and her journey so far, through the highs and the lows, to find out what it takes to push yourself to the edge and be one of the most successful athletes the sport has ever seen. So, without further ado, here's Rachel Atherton. Rachel Atherton, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. Thanks for inviting me to Atherton HQ on this sunny, what month are we in? April. Sunny afternoon.
Well, thanks for coming.
Yeah, it's awesome. So I do a fair chunk of research, and normally it's not that hard, but there's a lot of interviews with you out there, and there's a lot of information. I didn't really know where to start or where to go with it. But yeah. I looked at Wikipedia because that's the source of all genuine information.
My Wikipedia page is awful.
Well, the thing that, thing that confused me was that it says your nickname is Waynehead.
Yeah, it was. I guess it is more of a family nickname, really.
Where's that come from?
I don't know. I don't know. Brownie calls me Wayne. I guess a mixture between like Wayne's World, and there was a kid at school when I was little called Wayne, who's really weird. And I don't know what the connection was between me and him, but yeah, I don't know.
It stuck.
Yeah, but
strange.
Gloss over that.
We'll move
Not
on.
Not the coolest nickname. We'll move on. So I reinvented myself when Instagram was born.
Ah, right. There you go. So for latest nicknames, see Instagram.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, yeah. Let's start, I guess, right back from the start, because that's where most of these go from. And
yeah.
I'm kind of interested because obviously I know bits about your history, but I don't know kind of all of it. Wales wasn't home initially, was it? You guys were like born down south.
Yeah. Southerners, which is a shame. No. Yeah, we moved around a lot. We were born in Salisbury. Uh-huh. And then we lived in Devon for most of our childhood and then moved to Somerset. Just as we started mountain biking, really, and then moved up to Wales here when things got serious.
Serious, yeah. But it was BMX before mountain bike, is that right?
Yeah, so we sort of grew up around kind of like an hour or so from Exeter, okay. right in the countryside there. Dan rode all the time, like as a kid, just lived in the middle of nowhere. So, you know, all kids just ride bikes and that's what we did. And then Dan started racing BMX. Don't really know how or why. I guess he used to read like Ride and like Dig and stuff a lot. So he thought he'd give the racing a go. And Mum and Dad like broke up at the same time. So I guess racing was a way to spend time with Dad over the weekends.
Okay.
And then we used to hate mountain bikers though.
Really? Why?
We really did. We thought they were like just really like all lycra and like not cool and
yeah.
just with no like skills or anything.
It was a different sport back then, wasn't it? I guess it was yeah. it was the lycra brigade and it, like, yeah, it took a lot so. Of stuff from road biking yeah. and yeah.
But yeah, BMX was awesome and it's such a good way to get into the sport and develop so many skills and it's easy to do because you just go to the track and go round and round. You don't have to go up a mountain. And
yeah.
Yeah, so that was awesome. Dad raced for a bit and Dad was in like 40 plus cruiser and I used to race on an old, I thought it was a BMX. Dan built it for me and all the boys would say, that's not even a BMX. And I'd say, yes, it is. And they'd say, why has it got bottle cage mounts and stuff? And I'd say, oh, Christ. I think it's a mountain bike, isn't it? But yeah, it was good. BMX is a big part of our lives, yeah. even still, really.
So as a mountain bike hater at that point in time, like how did that transition happen to that becoming an acceptable thing to do? Less
I think we just moved house. So we raced okay. BMX for years and we loved it. And we traveled like around the country with Dad and in the tents and we went to all the nationals and all the races and it was pretty good family really. And then we were doing pretty well at it. We all won like the Southwest Champs, which was kind of like the biggest thing for us. And then I was like, so I was just having this battle with Liam Phillips' sister, Charlie Phillips, and oh my God, she was so good, so powerful and such a good racer. And Sinead Reed was a few years older, so she was obviously really good, but older than us. And I spent years trying to beat Charlie Phillips and race her, and I could never beat her. And I think that's where, for me, like my determination to win was born, definitely, yeah. getting just beaten by her every race. But then we moved house, and we just didn't have a BMX track near. And so the nearest thing was the woods and the hills.
Yeah.
And you're a product of your environment, really. So you just do what's around. And so cool. we started riding mountain bikes.
Yeah. And took to it straight away. Did you fairly quickly get into the racing? Because that was like Welsh Dragon kind of time,
yeah.
wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty quick, I think. Dan bought a Scott Octane. And just before we moved... just after we moved and he had like this shrine in his bedroom and like he had all his BMX trophies around, but like with the downhill bike there, and he saved up for like 3 years and yeah. And that was like a beast of a thing. It's all Dan really, you know, I don't know what made him think, oh, let's start doing this. Or there's a couple of lads in the village, that raced, and where our house was, there was a really cool hill. And then the other side of the town of the hill was the town with the school. So we'd ride to school in the morning, in Wells, the school, and the hill's Split Rock, which I know a lot of people still ride. So we'd ride to school and stop and shred some trails for like an hour in the morning and then carry on to school. And just the Southwest, the Southern Series was a pretty good scene, you know, like there was really good good race series, NECC events, like Ashcombe, Bratton, and then the Welsh Dragons was like the next step up, really. And Dan kind of was the driving force behind it. And we just started going to mountain bike races instead.
Yeah.
Dad had a caravan and we just all schlep around the Southwest in that and going on these little road trips to South Wales in between weekend races and doing what Dan envisioned.
Wicked. And were you pretty competitive straight away? Were you at the front end of the field pretty quickly?
Yeah, I think for me, it's always been the competition that's been the attractive thing. That's what I've always preferred to do is race. And then I never really rode a bike in between races. I'd just go back to school and do netball or yeah. hockey or whatever it was, and then go to the races at the weekend and try and win, because that's all I wanted to do. And Dan used to say, if you're going to do well, you need at the races, you need to ride in between during the week. And I'd say, oh, I don't think I enjoy this enough to do, to ride in the week as well after school. But yeah, I think there wasn't many girls racing, so it was quite easy to get a taste for that.
Okay, yeah,
to podium get first. Spot, really, yeah.
Yeah.
You get third, which is last, but you're still on the podium. And
yeah.
There was like Emily Horridge, who was like the girl, you know, she was like the top mountain biker and really good at dirt jumps and stuff, Rhianne Atherton. And then obviously like Tracy Mosley and Helen Gaskell and Helen Mortimer and those girls, Adele Croxon. So it's a pretty strong national scene, yeah. Which I got to quite quickly after a few years as a goth in my teenage years.
Nice. I was looking back on Roots and Rain, and based on that, I'm sure not all the results are on there, but there's a lot of the old Welsh Dragon stuff's on there.
Yeah, they were so gnarly for like a 13, 14-year-old girl. Oh, my God.
They're gnarly now. Yeah,
like, fair play.
Because Riola's an old dragon track, isn't it?
Yeah, and I was dreading going there this weekend because thinking how hard it used to be in Taff Buggy and Mountain Ash.
Yeah.
Just so muddy and gnarly. And I used to race in like my PE kit and then go to school on the Monday. Like, they're like, what the hell has happened to your PE kit? It's so muddy.
Awesome.
I remember we actually stayed at Jason Carpenter's house, and Manon and her sister shared a room so that me and Dad could have Manon's room. And then X amount of years later, we were racing each other at the World Cups.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah. And then obviously work your way through those, a lot of success. I saw a lot of first places at Welsh Dragons. And you'd have been in junior then, I guess. Youth junior.
And they had the coolest trophies, like a chain ring with like a dragon etched out, like laser cut out of the metal inside. And I used to cover them in bleach and then put them all over my coat that I wore to school. So I had this weird like black coat with like these bleached Welsh dragon chain rings all over them. God knows what people at school thought of me.
This was part of the goth phase.
Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah.
I can't imagine you as a goth.
It's a learning experience, I guess, that everyone goes through.
Wicked. And then so 2004 was your first World Cup, and it was Fort William.
Yeah.
Junior.
What
was that like? Because that must be, I mean, you can't prepare for your first World Cup, can you, really?
God, yeah. I don't really remember much about it. All I remember is having to go back to school afterwards and do my GCSEs. And being gutted I couldn't go to the next ones in Europe and stuff. And I think as a Brit, racing and riding at Fort William as you're a kid growing up then makes the World Cup there a lot easier.
Okay.
Because you've already been there and you kind of know how gnarly it was, but damn, Fort William, it's a lot easier than it used to be. With that, it used to have such a big pedal at the bottom at the finish. But anyway, yeah, I did it and got absolutely smoked. And it was amazing though, yeah. I think that was, is that the year Tracy won, or was that the year before?
I don't know, actually. Yeah, she did have...
She won the first one, so that, maybe that was 2002 or something.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah, so you'd have been up against like Missy, Anne Caro, Tracy, those kind of girls at that time.
Yeah, but yeah, I just remembered, just having a great time and been pretty... out of my depth.
And then so you moved on, like in 2005, junior world champ, Lavigne. So it didn't take you long to get from first World Cup to...
No, it must have been 2006, I think, wasn't it?
I've got 2005 written down, but I might be wrong. I don't know. But early on.
Yeah.
That's a huge leap, isn't it? From
because the first junior world champs was in Leger and I broke my collarbone. There'd already been a lot of injuries, even at the start. And there was a girl, Scarlett Hagen, a Kiwi. She was on fire. She was really good, amazing racer, and she was the same age. So she was like the girl to beat. And I broke my collarbone at the European Champs in Poland just before Leger, and then tried to race Leger a few weeks later, which didn't go too well. And then Petey crashed.
Oh, that was that year, wasn't it?
Yeah. And then the following year, I managed to go to Lavigne, and that was a pretty, I always think it's so hard for junior girls, you know, you have, especially at World Champs, super early morning practice, so the tracks are always kind of greasy and like covered in like a fine layer of dew, and I crashed that morning and hurt my shoulder, and the BC doctor had to give me an injection into my shoulder. so I could race. And that was like pretty full on really for...
How old would you have been like?
I guess 17.
Yeah.
But yeah, I won and that was like pretty epic. I remember I'd always, you know, as a kid, you so many dreams and stuff. And I remember I used to write like my school English essays about racing and I loved English and I was quite good at it. And I used to write all my essays about racing. And there was one essay and it was about the world championships and then like crossing the line and realizing I'd won and seeing my brother there and how proud he was and stuff. And then when I won the junior world champs, it was all coming true and Dan and G were there. And I was thinking, this is mad, you know, because all I've ever wanted to do is make Dan and G proud of me and kind of do what they do really. So yeah, pretty emotional.
Yeah. And did that stoke the fire to keep going out and getting more wins? Was that like, okay, I can do this at world level?
I don't know. I think it was definitely different back then. Like everything just kind of happened. It wasn't like a decision where you say, okay, in 10 years time, I'm going to be world champion, or in 5 years, I'm going to win this and this. You just kind of go with the flow and do it, you know, and you go to races, it's good fun, you're kind of good at it. It kind of unfolds, you know. We've never really had like a big master plan, or certainly not in the early days. It kind of just started happening and you couldn't really get off it. You were on the train and it was all going ahead.
Wicked. And that, yeah, it moved on from there. And it was sort of around like 2008 where you first started to get regular senior World Cup wins. And I think that was your first overall and first elite world champs.
Yeah, that was 2008 was a big year for me and for the Athertons, I guess. That was kind of the point where I kind of thought, oh, I can do this as a career and you can make a living out of it. I think even when I was in a junior, I was still at college and studying and stuff. And I remember seeing mum and dad down and saying, I think I can make a go of this and I want to race. I don't want to go to college anymore. And them saying, well, I don't know, because the boys both dropped out and we don't know if we want all of you to be dropouts. And I said, give me like a year. And if I can't get a good result in elite, then I'll go back to college. And I won my first World Cup in that year in Brazil. So that was the ticket I needed to keep going and keep doing it.
Excellent. So you were you were obviously pretty keen to focus on it full time then.
Yeah. I think when you're young, you just kind of go with it and see what happens. And then for me, it was seeing Tracy win Fort William one year that was kind of like seeing her win that and stand on the podium. And it was so emotional and everyone was crying and she was crying and it was so cool. And I remember standing in the crowd and thinking, that's what I want to do. Like, I want to be like her. I want to do that. This is what I want to do. And that was, for me, that was the point, like the only point I remember making an actual decision to do it, I guess, as a profession try.
And at that point, was the enjoyment for mountain biking there? Like you said early on, it was kind of, you wanted to win, but you weren't necessarily that bothered about riding in between the races.
Yeah.
Had that started to change by then, or were you still kind of quite wind driven?
Yeah, I think I was still quite, competitive, and it was really about the racing and the winning. And I can remember in 2009 when I got really injured, that was the year where not being able to ride and not being able to just ride at the weekend or in the evenings for fun, that was the point where I was like, actually, I love this. And it's what makes me happy and it's what makes my life feel full and complete and makes me feel like a better person is riding my bike, regardless of whether I'm racing or not. And that was kind of, apart from the year out and been injured so much, that was like a really silver lining to the whole kind of that whole episode, really learning that I did enjoy riding for riding's sake and realizing that I'd ride and enjoy it whether I was racing and winning or not. So that was pretty cool.
I was going to ask about that because it did seem like a little bit of a turning point for you. I mean, tell us a little bit about the crash if you're okay talking about it, because that It was pretty full on, right?
Yeah, it was pretty full on. I think looking back, it gets more kind of gnarly as the years pass. I mean, G and I won world champs, and I won the overall in 2008, and Dan and G and I, we all won in Andorra, and it was a sick year. And it was like, it was kind of, at some point you feel pretty invincible as a young athlete that's had some success. You know, you see it in all the guys and girls, and you get this kind of confidence and you feel like nothing can touch you. And we went to America for our winter training that year, and we were having an awesome time. And we used to do a lot of like 10 mile time trials, and we just went out on the road, and I went first and just head down, and I was listening to music, which I never do now, but had my headphones in, and it was like a road with houses on it.
Okay, yeah, I don't know.
A road with houses on it. So it's quite quiet, yeah. And cars parked down the side, and I just remember like head down, looked up, and there was a truck, like a pickup truck, come in, and I was like, shit, swerve, and naturally swerved as I would in the UK. Obviously, we were in the States, so we both ended up swerving the same way.
Yeah.
Like when you meet someone on the pavement, then we both swerve back the other way together, and then bang. And I just remember being like, holy shit, this is bad. And I like smashed into the front of the pickup on my road bike, like went up over the handlebars, like hit the windscreen, just shit everywhere, like carnage. And I don't even really remember it. I just remember being on the floor afterwards and the boys come in and just been like blood all everywhere, like couldn't see, and just covered in blood, and my shoulder like hanging out its socket, like totally fucked. And it was like probably worse for Dan G, just finding me like that on the floor. G was pretty shook up by it, but my shoulder was dislocated, and which I knew, and I'd done it before a few times in like four cross races and stuff in back in the day, but it was dislocated, but it was massive. It was so swollen, like up to my like chin. It was like pretty scary, and I had like no feeling and stuff. So a helicopter came, and it was like this big drama, and I flew up to San Francisco Hospital, and the bill for the accident was massive because it was a road accident. They sent like, you know, all the stuff, and the hospital, everyone was on standby for like a road traffic accident. God knows what they expected. But yeah, I had all the scans and everything, and I just dislocated my shoulder and torn all the nerves. So
wow.
It was as good as it could have been, really. Glass everywhere, yeah. In me, but yeah, I was pretty lucky, I guess, to get away with just a bad shoulder.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And then, so that was a nerve, did you have a nerve graft to like, yeah. Fix that?
Yeah, so we stayed in America and they couldn't do anything because it was so swollen and damaged. So I came home and over that year just had like 3 or 4 different surgeries to try and repair it. And the nerve graft was the biggest thing. They took a nerve like from my leg. Which nerve was it? Axial nerve.
Okay.
Kind of not the main nerve from like your spine, but the nerve that branches off that feeds like the deltoid and the shoulder muscles. So that had just been torn like front and back. So they put the nerve from my leg. They transplant it into the right place because nerves are so sensitive and they're so complicated. They have to have a structure to travel along and to uh-huh. find their way to the other side. And that was pretty nerve-wracking because, no pun intended, I didn't know if it was going to work really. And I had like no deltoid muscle at all, like total wastage. And it looked pretty grim really. But you know, it really worked, and like, incredible surgeons. And I've met people that have done similar things since and had worse luck and not been able to repair them, or you know, so I was definitely lucky with that.
Yeah. Does it leave you with some kind of numbness in your leg where they've taken that nerve away, or does that grow back?
It's a sensory nerve. Oh, so okay. Like the whole left side of my foot to my ankle is totally numb. Like yeah. I can't feel anything. But apart from that, it seems fine really. Yeah. But it's not like every injury leaves you with stuff, you know, you're never as good as new. And that, you know, my shoulder's definitely not as strong. And I think I've got like 60% of original like muscle mass.
Yeah.
In the deltoid, so it's not too bad, but it's not as good as it could be.
Yeah.
But you just compensate and you get all wonky and you figure it out.
But that time kind of away from the sport and time to think,
yeah,
like you say, it gave you maybe a refreshed kind of enjoyment of riding and
yeah,
maybe a focus that
yeah,
improved.
Definitely. Yeah, because suddenly you've got the thing you love most in the world taken away and you can't do it anymore. And it was a year really without riding, and I'd go to the pub, and we lived in Llangannog then, and that's where Revo is now, and it's such an awesome area. But I just went to the pub every weekend, and like we played football on the road and like drank cider, and I was like, this sucks, you know. and to have that real passion to get back on the bike, and I remember having like, I had an injury loop that I'd try and do after every kind of rehab, and it just was like riding up the road and back down the fire road. And every time I rode that fire road after like having a few months off, it was just the sickest feeling, like so fun. And that was it. You know, I realized that bikes were it for me. That's what,
yeah,
that's what made me happy and yeah, a better person, which we can all relate to really.
Definitely. And was it Alan Milway at that point that kind of helped you rebuild and regenerate some upper body strength? And
no, it was before, that was before Milway. It was Darren Roberts.
Oh yeah, okay. Conehead.
Yeah, we went through quite a lot of big injuries with the cone, and he was out there with us in America when it happened, and as was Sven taking photos. And yeah, I mean, we worked then with Cone for years afterwards. And Cone was the kind of first coach that Red Bull hooked us up with originally, and changed us from being just kind of kids that didn't know what they were doing to people that took their training quite seriously and wanted to get to where they wanted to go. You know, and Cone was awesome. He's such a good, fun guy, and he knows so much. He knows how to make training fun, really.
What were the big changes for you at that point then, like in your kind of strength or in your physique? What areas did he focus on?
Well, it was a pretty big change, really, because we lived in Llangannog, and it was pretty ghetto set up. We didn't have a garage, and like we had like all these tarpaulins strung up between trees, and it was just pretty ghetto, really. And we also started working with a psychologist that Red Bull hooked us up with, Jamie Edwards. And him and the cone kind of changed everything really for us, and made us realize that for us, I don't know if it's the same for everyone, but you know, we wanted to be the best, and they said you've got to live like the best, you know, so you need to build a garage, and we built a little garage and gym in it, and it kind of changed the way we looked at things really. I'm not saying you have to be like super professional about everything, but you just have to have the right equipment to do the right job.
Yeah.
So Cone, yeah, I mean, I don't think I'd do the sessions now that he'd set back then. They're probably too hard, but we went pretty full tilt into it, like real gnarly sessions, and he would make up like we'd go on training camps, and then G would like go out, you know, drinking or whatever, and he'd make up really like horrible hangover sessions that we'd all have to do. He'd say, if one's cut, everyone bleeds and stuff like this. And he'd like wake us up really early in the morning with like the Eye of the Tiger music, and like just like, it was pretty fun, you know. He was like a kind of an like army background, so he knew how to make it like structured but pretty fun at the same time.
Wicked.
So yeah, good memories of the cone of those years.
Yeah, and you were all still living together at that point.
Yeah.
What was that like? Cause,
horrific. I know.
Well, yeah, because I mean, I've got a sister, and we get on really well now, but we haven't always, yeah, for sure. Like, how was that relationship with the three of you in one place?
It wasn't super that. It was competitive. Awesome. Yeah. Yeah, it was awesome. And I, you know, hands down couldn't have done it without the boys. We lived in Llangannog, and Mum moved out and left us. She'd had enough of like, you know, just how hectic and crazy it was all the time. So we were like running riot really, and it was sick. We had like the best yard, like all the jumps that Dan had built, and all these dirt jumps and a track and stuff, and had tracks and downhill tracks everywhere. And it was just awesome. Like, we just totally, as people have since said, you know, like we lived the dream like that they imagined it to be like. And it was like that for a few years. But interspersed with serious racing, you know, that's, to be good at racing and to be good on your bike, you've got to ride your bike a lot and you've got to train hard. That's the end of it, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's what we did. And there was definitely some, there was definitely between G and I, like, big arguments and stuff. And we also had Clay Porter living with us at that time. So we were sort of doing the Atherton project, and that was pretty full on, definitely a full on few years of Clay being there. And poor Clay, just like in the middle of Wales, from California to Wales, no like shops or anywhere to get food. But yeah, it was pretty cool. Definitely pushed us all on, you know, all striving for the same thing, all trying to get to the same thing. But at the end of the day, you've got to ride your bike. So we had a lot of fun, and Dan would build like these big wooden ramps, and we'd just drive around like the local area, like putting the ramp up and hitting different, like landing on banks or in the lake and different stuff like that. And then we'd get some serious training done in between road rides, where I'd try and like get Dan to tow me up the hills because I was lazy, and pretty good fun gym sessions. And yeah.
What was it like having that level of media attention then, having Clay kind of literally living with you and filming a lot of what you were doing?
It was pretty funny. I guess it was definitely a novelty those years we did it, and then it definitely got harder as it went on, but it was pretty good fun really, just trying to show what it's like to be a mountain biker and a professional in inverted commas. I guess the more kind of proliferant the social media has become, is you feel like now I feel more of a pressure to have that kind of thing going on than I did then.
Yeah.
It was definitely, you just kind of took it in your stride.
Harder to get away from it now.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. And it's more like, yeah, I don't know. But it was awesome. Yeah, the Athens project was good fun. And Clay was a pretty good guy to live with. We did some big kind of night filming, and where we had like all these generators that we like lugged up the mountain and walked down the track, and then we just sit there till like setting up until like 3 a.m. when it was nice and dark, and then do some night filming. And yeah, it was pretty
special times.
So
you worked your way back up, you know, from your injury, and kind of rebuilt yourself effectively, and again, you know, picking up amazing results. But start of the 2014 season, I think, was it Peter Maritzburg? You picked up some kind of illness that sort of affected you for quite a while, really, that season.
Yeah, I think since that crash, the road accident in 2009, and then really, till kind of, it was 2013 when I finally won World Champs again. But those few years were a real struggle with like injury, and I kept getting hurt in my shoulders. I'd hurt the opposite one and then the opposite one, and more surgery. I think I went for like four or five years with a surgery every year, and it just wears you down, you know, and you're trying to race and you're trying to be good, and you're not quite there, and it really does take its toll on you. And then in 2014 I just got to the first World Cup in South Africa and was so sick, you know, picked up a virus and ended up in hospital and just was like in pieces, really, just really ill. And it was like, I guess looking back, it's like the accumulation of all those years of pushing yourself and not really resting and trying. It kind of manifests itself. Maybe not, you know, not really knowing how to eat as well as you need to, and all this stuff that you learn naturally as time goes on as an athlete. But that was a pretty grim year, really. Like, managed at that race in South Africa, came out of hospital for the race and did my 2 practice runs, did qualifying in the race, and I got second somehow, but I went back into hospital for another week, and then flew to Australia for the next World Cup. Somehow won that World Cup, and that was it. I got home and I was wrecked, like so bad. Just stayed in bed, like crying, just couldn't even do anything, like so fatigued, I guess. Just, you know, you can call it burnout, chronic fatigue, post-viral fatigue, whatever. Yeah. And I think most athletes, especially the girls, have had some sort of variation of that, whether they talk about it or not. You know, it takes a lot out of you. Been a racer, and you never really give yourself a break. The off season's short and there's a lot to cram into it, so that was a massive learning experience for me. And again, kind of opens your eyes to what you actually enjoy, you know, what do you want to do? What are you doing with your life?
Yeah.
What are you doing all this for? And for me, I guess that the answer was that I wanted to win. and that's what I enjoyed. And that's what made me feel like happy. So
yeah,
that was kind of, it was good in a way because it cleared it up and made, it makes you look for answers when you're really in a bad way. And for me, like finding like health and acupuncture and stuff like that, that really kind of changed it for me really. And like opened a lot of doors, which I feel really helped me still. So yeah, every cloud has a silver lining, I guess.
I was going to ask a bit about that, like lifestyle changes. Like what kind of things over your career have you changed that you found that have helped you? Because there's kind of like a spiritual feeling to some of your stuff these days that wasn't there in the early days.
Yeah, and I think that's the difference between being a kid and being like just totally guns out, you know, going for it and being a bit wild and living that kind of crazy lifestyle that's not sustainable. You can't keep that going forever. And then I got ill and everything changed. You know, Dan decided, just coincided with that same sort of period. Dan wanted to move out, and like we all live together still. And Dan wanted to move to Vancouver and have that Canadian lifestyle. He couldn't go because he didn't want to leave the family. So he went to the next best thing, which was the west coast of Wales. So he moved like and found the W Forest and found that place, and he moved there, and that was kind of like a massive change. And for me, it was really like emotional, him moving out. And he's always been the guy like that I base my life around. You know, he's kind of like my leader and G as well. And Dan moved out, and it was kind of like, do I stay here and make my own life? Do I go with him? Like, what do I do? And I remember trying to decide, like, who am I? Like, am I a country person? Am I a town person? Like, where do I want to live? Where should I live to be a good mountain biker, to be a good racer? In the end, I just moved in with Dan. He couldn't get rid of me. But that's a lifestyle change. You know, everyone goes through a period where they're like suddenly not sure who they are or what they're, where they want to go next or what they want to do with their lives. And everyone gets to it at some point, maybe a couple of times throughout their life. And you do have to kind of sit down and think, where do you want to go and what do you want to do? And I knew that for me, it's that kind of, I wanted to be outdoors. I wanted that natural lifestyle. I didn't want to live in town or be kind of clean cut, wear like super nice clothes. I wanted to be out there and doing what I loved and have the wind in my hair and make me feel like alive. And so I thought, I'm just going to move to Wales and further into Wales, lived with Dan for a bit and just see what happened. And I never was happier. You know, it's such a wild place out there. It's awesome. And subsequently met like my boyfriend and we moved into the forest and, you know, it was a massive decision to do all those changes, but ones that if you're totally honest with yourself and you really listen to that voice inside, you know what it's telling you, really. You know what it's saying to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think a lot of people feel like they're not super happy or content, but yet they don't change anything. They're scared or they're nervous or they don't feel like they deserve to have that lifestyle that they dream of. But I say to people, just do it, you know. You can choose anything that you want to do. You can choose where to live. You can choose what to do. You can choose who to speak to. You can choose what to eat. You can choose what to do. It's everything is a choice and it's your choice. People say, oh, I can't afford this. I can't, you know, you can live in a caravan. Like, you know, just do what, if you want to make a change and you want to be happier, you know that something is going to be right for you, do it. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And I'm a big believer in it. Just grit your teeth and do it, because you never know, and 90% of the time it'll work out.
Yeah, it's kind of where this podcast came from.
Yeah, so exactly. Yeah.
It can work.
Yeah.
It's hard work, but...
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Yeah.
You got to put the graft in, but you can get there.
Yeah. Rather than just staying in the same kind of cycle and not being as happy as you could be.
Yeah. And you, like you say, you discovered acupuncture, but like things like yoga, some of the kind of nutrition side of things you seem to focus on a lot more these days.
Yeah, and I think that's all part of, you know, been of trying to stay alive. You know, it's life takes it out of you, and you've got to put it back in. You've got to give your body the tools to keep going and to keep working. Especially the way we all live now, it's hard. You know, everything taxes your body, whether you know it or not. You know, I can feel when I come out of an off season that I've been on my phone more than in race season. I'm not quite as sharp. Like the first British national, I'm like, I can't even see the track. Like I can feel like I've got phone head, you know.
Interesting.
You're on your phone more in the winter, and then race season you're not on it as much. And just little things, you know, everything is stressing your body. So you've got a really, it's really important to find ways to counteract those, all that stuff that we do. You know, we're sat here right now and I can hear the fridge like humming away, and it's electricity and it's getting into my zone, and it's not ideal for your body, you know. I'm really interested in it, just all this, like, just what makes you feel better, you know, trial and error, I guess.
And where have you ended up then with the kind of diet side of things? Like, pretty heavy veg focused.
Yeah, I mean, it's all pretty, I don't follow like a super strict diet. I just want to feel as good as I can. And, you know, I eat loads of chocolate and I got a sweet tooth and I smash that stuff, you know, definitely more than I should. But I also know that if I don't, like, we went to the national this weekend and ate pretty badly for like 2 days, and I can feel my body going, oh, can you get back on track, please? I want some good stuff. It's just kind of, you do it for a while and you feel so much better that then you can't go back to not doing it. You know, people say, I don't know how to eat healthier, or I don't have the time, or stuff like this. But, you know, we buy all our veg at the local market and it's super cheap, like all organic. It's really cheap, and I've been trying to prove this winter by cooking like 100% from scratch, like super healthy meals, in like as quick as I can, just to prove that you can do it. You know, it's not a time thing; it's just knowing or having the confidence to do it. But I think that food's incredible. You know, you are what you eat. Really, you are.
Yeah, massively.
And so, if you can align those things with your body, because everyone's so different as well.
Yeah.
But there's just, I've not even scratched the surface, you know, I don't know anything. There's so much, like, the kind of Chinese, like, medicine and all that kind of way of living is so deep and so old, you know, the years they've been learning it. It's pretty cool. There's some pretty powerful things. You just got to open your eyes, I guess.
Yeah, try stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you've been trying like hot and cold stuff as well, with sauna and plunge pool.
Yeah.
Is that something you do regularly, or is that like...
I think it's, for me, it's rest. That's okay. The one of the biggest things. I think people would be, it's going to make me sound bad, people would be surprised how much I rest. And that's, again, like, you need that as you evolve as a human and as an athlete. And for me, it's like trying to let my body really, like, okay, don't just chill for a bit, you know. Mm-hmm. You're not going to fall off and crash or hurt yourself. And that relaxation and that rest is really important to be able to come back as high as you can and as fierce as you can, you know. Your body needs to be able to recruit everything. And I struggle with all the injuries I've had and all the surgeries and stuff to relax and to let go. So, rather than drink more alcohol, I try and do it other ways.
Okay.
And you found... Because I used to try and drink more alcohol.
Right.
To relax more, because I'm just like so tight but I don't really like it.
Okay.
So.
Yeah. So you found the sauna
try and find
stuff.
Other things.
Surely you're jumping into a freezing cold bucket of water. Does that relax you?
Well, I think it just makes you feel pretty alive, you know, invigorated, and makes your senses buzzing. But it's the same as anything, you know, things that take your focus up 110%, you know, think so you're not sat there thinking about this or that. Everything we do is pretty full on and mm-hmm. pretty, you're like always, how can I be better? How can I improve? How can I push myself? What is this good enough? Should I do this? Am I going to bed on time? Am I eating enough? Am I eating too little? Is this right? It's a constant just doubt and question.
Yeah, yeah.
And so anything that I do, I try and do like 100% so that it takes up my mind space. And especially now it's getting close to the race season. I'm at home trying to chill out, have lunch or whatever. I'm like carrying my laptop around with like TV programs on, because if they're not on, I can't switch off. I'm thinking about what's Tani doing, what's Pom Pom doing.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm like, Downton Abbey's playing like constantly just to take up that space in my head to give me a bit of a rest, you know.
Yeah.
And for different people, it is different things, you know. Minard drinks a lot. You know, G likes to drive his rally car.
Yeah. Have you tried any kind of meditative practice or?
I haven't, because I can't sit still for long enough.
Yeah, I can't.
It's so hard, yeah. Yeah. Unless I'm doing a sport or something physical.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're climbing or
okay.
riding your bike.
Fair play. Yeah. So going back to this 2014, then obviously kind of you were subpar through the illness side of things, and it gave some of the other girls, you know.
Yeah, I'm not taking anything away from those, you know, their results or Manon's achievements or anything that year. I'm just saying, you know, I felt as not as good as, but that's racing,
yeah,
you know, everyone has
yeah.
those years. So.
But they, you know, they stepped
Manon
it up.
Manon was fierce, you know, she's such a good rider and such a good racer, and everyone was gutted when she retired. It's a hell of a shame. But she's doing what she feels right for her. And
yeah.
She's enjoying her life and pushing herself
yeah.
in different ways.
True. But yeah, I guess it reminded you certainly what it feels like to lose. I was going to ask, like, how important do you think losing has been in your career? Is that where some of your fire comes from?
Yeah, I don't know. I always wonder, like, why do we need to compete? Why do all these athletes need to compete? Like, what is missing, or what are we all trying to prove to ourselves or whoever? And it's weird because, you know, I had my parents that they loved me, like I wasn't on the streets or anything. And yeah, I've got this need to like to win. I don't really know. I feel in some way, when you think about it too much, it's a bit embarrassing to need to win. Do you know what I mean? It's weird.
I can see what you mean, yeah.
But yeah, definitely I am driven by the been, you know, beaten, and definitely they do stay with you and they stay with me, definitely, and it gives me like a fire to train. And that's what 2014, oh god, I'm gonna cry. It's just everything's so emotional, and I feel like because we're family as well, and G's racing and Dan and everything's so invested in it, everything's so much more heightened. So that year in Hafjell, Norway, and I came down, I nearly won, and then I lost it all on the last section of track, which is similar to every other time. And Manon won by like 0.04 or something.
Yeah, it was a tiny margin, wasn't it?
And then G won the men's race, and I was like, I was devastated after my race, and then G won, and I was even more devastated that I hadn't won, because then we would have done the double again, and oh my God, just so much. And I literally felt a physical like pain in my heart from that that race. And it's, yeah, I mean, it took me a long time to get over it, and I still probably am not over it.
Yeah, fair play. Well, it certainly drove a lot of hard work, and then the 2016 season happened where you had a perfect season and won everything. And watching from the outside, and I'm guilty of it as well, it looked pretty easy.
Oh,
and I'm
no,
sure a lot of people
think
that. But this is it. I want to hear your side, because I'm guessing it wasn't, right? The pressure must have been rising.
Yeah, I don't think any win is ever easy. Definitely not. And arguably, the more you win, the harder it gets with all the things that go with it, the expectation and the pressure and the knowledge that you can win is almost the most dangerous thing, because then you know you can do it and you've just got to do it. Whereas when you're a bit of an underdog and it's kind of not expected, or you're struggling, or it's almost easier because it's, you just go for it and you don't have anything to lose really. But yeah, I mean, 2015 and 2016 were pretty didn't feel any different to any other year, but they ended up being, yeah, incredible. And I think in 2015 at Lourdes, Rago won, and then I won everything then until 2017, which is mental. At the time, it didn't feel that mad, but now, after, and then you get injured again, and then you're like, oh, actually, this is really difficult. It's more crazy looking back on it that nothing went wrong, you know.
Yeah.
No punches or no dogs on track or whatever. It's mad, and I don't know. I just know that it was, every race was its own race. You know, you take each race as it comes and you focus and you go through the process. And I just felt like, I don't know, just did it.
Did you feel any more kind of anxious as that season was progressing? Like, did you start feeling a pressure to complete that perfect season, or was every race just another
race?
Yeah,
I remember it got to the point where people had started mentioning, like, oh, this is going to be the longest winning streak if you do this race. And I'd be like, shut up. And then they'd say, Dan would say, oh, if you win this, this is going to be this statistic. And I just didn't want to know. Like, yeah. I just said, don't even tell me anything. Don't even, like, it's just a race. It's just the next World Cup. And then it got to the World Cup final in Andorra. It was so close. It was within reach. And then I was like, we started talking about it and thinking about it because you have to be tactical. And then I got a bad back and I just remember thinking, oh my God, all this work is just going up in smoke because I've got a bad back and I don't even think I can ride. And I was like devastated. And I remember Dan saying, you've just got to try it. Just try and ride. And I was like, I can't, my back, I can't even walk. And I just tried and everything again, like, fell into place. And then we got to World Champs the following week or 2 weeks in Val d'Isère. And that was it. That was going to be like the perfect season with World Champs at the end. And it was mad, like, just so much emotion in there. But at the same time, I just didn't even think about it. Yeah. Just totally. That's what I'm a big believer in, is like a routine. Because there's so much going on in your head. There's so many decisions to make on a race weekend, on the track, on your bike and all these things, that when you, all the other time when you can have a routine and you can just switch off and follow that routine. And you know, if you follow the routine, you're going to end up at the top of the hill ready to race.
Yeah.
That's a lifesaver because you don't have to think,
yeah.
You know, I know if I went, I go get up at this time and go on my warm up bike and do this many practice runs and do this and this at 1 o'clock or whatever in the afternoon, you'll be at the top of the hill and ready to go.
Gives you a focus as well, I suppose. So
yeah, and takes you
park the anxiety a bit and focus on the process. And
but I always, like, I had some pretty good quotes in my locker in the race truck, things to do and things to try, like smile. And I always smile at a race because you're walking around and you're at the top of the hill and just sat there with a massive smile on your face, like absolutely shitting it, because smiling releases, you know, all those things that it releases, and it does kind of work. Use your GoPro, because your GoPro is saving your energy, you know. And I would always forget. I'd be like, oh, practice is over, I've forgotten to use it. And then you just having those little reminders to do the things that you need to do.
Yeah. So you mean to record a run so you can then sit
and
watch
then, it? Yeah. Because I'd always forget and then be like, oh shit, now practice is over and I haven't got any footage to watch.
Right.
And then when you don't forget, which I never forget now, you just sit there and you go and you can do like 20 runs if you want and you just sat there chilling.
Yeah.
It's been amazing the last, yeah. And then my favourite quote is, anxiety is dangerous when not controlled.
Okay.
So a bit of anxiousness, a bit of nerves is good. You know, it's good for you.
Yeah.
It really is. I remember Vules saying that. And I was always like, what is he on about? Like, how, what? Nerves, what? And then suddenly, like, over the years, you do realise that when you're more confident and when you're, like, having fun on the track, and it doesn't really go very well.
Okay.
Whereas when you're, like, struggling a bit and you're kind of, you're doubting, or you're a bit of an underdog for some reason, and you recruit everything, every experience, you bring all your A game and you smash it and you concentrate and you focus and you deliver. Whereas if you, for me anyway, when I'm like pretty good mood,
yeah,
never goes very well.
Fair enough.
So I guess over the years I've managed to invent all these dramas and problems to keep you sharp.
Yeah, I was going to ask, I mean, you've obviously, over your career, you've had the opportunity to work with a lot of pretty awesome coaches and mentors, both like physical, mental and life, I guess. Like what stuck with you over the years? What kind of advice or learnings has really stuck?
I guess everything's in there somewhere, but a lot of the work we did with the psychologist early on with Jamie Edwards, that was pretty kind of mind-blowing, and definitely I still use all those things today that he taught me. And
what sort of stuff was that? Is that a lot of the process focus?
Yeah, a lot of it's kind of half like life stuff, you know, like, and then half kind of performance and like race based, I guess. I don't know, like, it's hard to kind of put into words. The three E's, which are like evidence, energy and emotion. So the evidence is there in the past because you've done it before.
Yeah.
You know, whether you're trying to work up to doing a drop or a jump, or you don't just work up, you don't just do it. You've got to have worked your way up and you've got the evidence of those past accomplishments. And in theory, there's no reason why you would have forgotten all that overnight and you can't do it again. Energy is like, what are you focusing your energy on? Where are you wasting energy? Are you wasting energy worrying about things, or physical energy? And then emotion as well. Do you need to give that emotion to that thought? But I don't know, it's... just little quotes, really, and things that you do, and you start, like, what can you do today to help you reach your end goal? You know, you don't wake up when you're 10 and think, oh, I want to be world champion. Well, Tane did, because that's her whole dream.
Yeah.
Most people don't. It's too big a goal. You can't get there, you know. Yeah. You have to work towards it in little steps, whether it's you've broken your arm, I want to start riding again, but what can you do today to get to that end goal? So today what you can do is do your physio, or today you can rest. And that's something that really helps me over my career, because, you know, you have to do what's necessary for that day, and sometimes it isn't what you want to do. You know, I'd rather go for a ride, but I know I've got a rest, or I'd rather it's sunny but I should go in the gym and stuff. So that's been a really good little, it's such an easy thing to remember, but what can you do today? Because that's all you've got.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry about tomorrow or yesterday.
Yeah, cool. And what do you think's been most detrimental on your success over the duration of your career? Obviously, injuries have played a big role, but is there anything else that you kind of feel has hampered you at certain points?
Yeah, I'd say injuries. Bloody injuries, hampering still. I think I always feel like I wish I was more of a girly girl, because I feel like that would, I'd be like a better package, but I don't really care.
In whose eyes though? In like,
I don't know,
sponsors'
I guess
eyes, or?
I'm guilty as anyone is, everyone is, of feeling like they should be, you know, prettier, or should be wearing nicer clothes or stuff like that. It's just so ingrained in us that it's all about how you look.
And yeah, it's a shame, really, isn't it?
I genuinely sometimes think, like, why can't I just be really good at putting makeup on? But I'm not. So I tried to change who I was, but I am who I am. And I don't really, you know, I live in the countryside and I spend all the time outdoors. And I mean, it's probably the only thing that I care about that I shouldn't care about.
Yeah.
And probably most girls are the same, really. And as the older I get, the more worried I become about it, that I'm too wrinkly or, you know, it's stupid things. But, you know.
Everyone has those sort of worries inside, yeah. Don't they? Like, I think it's fairly natural. It's a shame, but it's pretty natural.
And you see, like, well, I can't remember who it was. No, it was that Dina Asher-Smith, and she said she, an eight-year-old, like, track and field girl came up to her and said, how can I, like, lose weight? And I was like, what? No way.
Crazy.
It's so gnarly.
Yeah.
And now I feel like if I've got some sort of platform to try and make it, to try and, like, show that everyone is, you know, it's normal to be just a normal person. It's not normal to be, like, I don't know.
Not everyone's a supermodel.
Yeah. But no, I think, yeah, injuries have probably been the most hampering thing. And sometimes living in Wales, I think, is hampering because there's just not as much good infrastructure here.
Right.
Like, I spend longer in the car to get anywhere.
So, like, physio or a gym.
Yeah,
or,
the physios aren't as good as a major city or town.
Right.
Everything's just, but on the other hand, you've got the best riding and the best tracks and the biggest mountains. So yeah. It kind of cancels itself out, really.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Fair play. Like you said, you're one of the older women in sport now, and we've talked about a lot of the sacrifices.
I didn't say that. You said that.
Sorry.
It's my favourite thing to say.
Well, there you go. And you've made a lot of sacrifices, right? Like you've had a lot of injuries. You've given up a lot of time for training and all this focused activity, and, you know, pushed yourself hard. How much longer do you think you want to do it for? Like, obviously winning's still super important to you, and you obviously love riding, but how long do you think you'll stick at World Cup downhill? Because
that old question.
Yeah.
I feel like I've been asked that for like the last 20 years.
Well, Petey pushed it pretty far, didn't he? So
it's funny because, you know, like the last few years when I meet new people, whoever it is, and I say, they ask about what you do and you tell them, the first question that they ask is, how long are you going to keep doing it? Not like, are you any good? Or, you know,
strange.
The first thing they ask is how long, and you get to a point where, and even sponsors really, and people in the industry, it's kind of got to the point where, like, that's all anyone asks and all anyone wants to know. And it kind of feels like you should step away because it's what expected. This is expected, and you're at that age, and it's all, and it's kind of like if I started to feel like a pressure to have to stop.
Strange, isn't it?
Because that's all anyone was talking about. Never mind that I just won World Champs or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, I definitely thought about it last year, and I definitely thought, a part of me thought that it was going to be my last year, definitely. But we had a pretty big winter of excitement, so I thought, oh, well.
Have another go.
I can't really stop now, can I? But, I mean, you know, it is hard, and racing is awesome. You know, it's given me everything. It's given me and the other girls and everyone that does it a life, you know. It's given us something to be passionate about, something to work towards every day. But it's also very difficult, and it definitely takes it out of you, and it's hard, you know. You do give your body to it, and you can't do it forever. So at some point you have to stop, and I would rather stop at the top of the game than at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
But that decision and that making that decision and knowing when that time is impossible to decide. So I don't know. Someone's going to have to tell me what to do because I don't know.
Keep going.
We're all
enjoying watching you race. So
well, thanks. But it's mad, you know. It's pretty gnarly when you think, that's it, I'm not going to race anymore. And you, like, it's your whole life. You know, I've been doing it since I was eight, and it literally is your lifeblood. And I don't know, it's a pretty addictive thing, you know. You are addicted to it, the speed and the adrenaline and the buzz and the travel and everything is, you are addicted to it. And I don't know what you would replace that with.
Yeah, have you ever thought about that? Because you've got, I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on, I guess. Well, you've got Atherton bikes now, keep you fairly busy. You've got the Atherton Academy stuff.
And maybe that's why we've done it, because we know that it's been so all-consuming over the last 20 years that the next step has to be all-consuming. You know, we have to give everything to it, because that's the only way we know how to live. And we always knew that doing a bit of this or a bit of that wouldn't be enough. You know, we've always wanted to do something, do whatever we're doing 110%. And it was kind of like, what should we do? What's it going to be? And then that was it, starting the bike company. And it's been as all consuming as we imagined.
It's amazing. And keeping it a secret from the mountain bike industry is impressive. And no one saw that coming, did they?
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty, I mean, it was a pretty, it was definitely a struggle to keep it quiet. Sorry, Sven. Poor Sven. He didn't like my comments on Pink Bike interview a few weeks ago, because I said I wouldn't tell him because he had a big mouth. He was a bit offended, but it's true. No one can keep a secret.
No.
Absolutely
it's
no
It's too
one.
Tempting. And that would have been a good secret. Like, yeah. That was one to have.
I barely kept it. But I mean, it was, you know, it was kind of like a two-way road, two roads next to each other. Uh-huh. Like we were doing the bikes, but we also kept our options open until we knew that we were going to have a bike.
Yeah, ready for this season.
Because it's been mental trying to get it ready for the first World Cup, let alone early enough that we could actually ride the thing before the World Cup. I was thinking, hang on, I'm not going into the first race on a brand new bike that I haven't ridden yet. But luckily, everyone has been amazing and the team has been working their socks off. So pretty lucky. And, you know, it's no secret that Robot Bike Company, they obviously existed and they are a company. And unfortunately they couldn't keep going for one reason or another.
Yeah.
So they closed down and we thought, this is the perfect scenario. We couldn't imagine a better way to start Atherton Bikes. So we started at Atherton Bikes. We started a new company and those guys came on board and together we've developed the Downhill Bike, which is an incredible bit of kit. So it's pretty exciting. I mean, regardless of what happens outside of, you know, what happens if anyone actually buys it. For us, it's been incredibly exciting. And
yeah, I bet.
Pretty cool. So
that's an amazing project. And it took it for its first win with you at the weekend at Riola.
Yeah. Yeah, that was pretty, it's mad. You go to the race and I was like, this is like such a massive deal. But at the same time, it was just like a British national. We were there in easy ups and it was like really cold. But yeah, the bike was, I was worried that it wasn't going to be a big bike track because the bike's sick. It wants to go flat out and it's a British track. It's a bit twisty and a bit fiddly. But the results speak for themselves, I guess. And I was pretty surprised. So yeah, it's a lovely bit of kit.
Excellent. Yeah. Look forward to seeing it at the World Cup.
I can't wait to race really because it is like an added kind of motivation and a different kind of level drive, I guess.
Exciting times. So you, through your success and, you know, all the results that you've had some pretty serious accolades with BT Sports Woman of the Year and various other bits and bobs. And I don't know how you'd prove this, but I'd be fairly confident in saying you're the most well-known British mountain biker these days.
That's all thanks to Jill.
Well, she's done a good job. Good work. Jill. But like, that's a big responsibility, I guess, as an ambassador for the sport and especially for the women's side of the sport. Like, how do you approach that? How do you look at it?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely worked pretty hard for a few years on getting that mainstream coverage. And, you know, Jill, she works with us and does everything. And she's really good at that kind of connection with the mainstream media.
Yeah.
And that's something we felt quite strongly about, getting it to new audiences and stuff. And then it kind of takes on a bit of a life of its own. Once you're in a few, you kind of, you know, they're interested in it. And it kind of, it's cool to see new people like opening their eyes to the sport. They're always so amazed by how fast-paced and how kind of dangerous and extreme it looks, but how professional it is. And yeah, it's cool seeing their reactions to it. We were pretty close for a while to getting it on like a mainstream channel. BT Sport wanted to show it, the World Cups. But there was a bit of an issue. But it's been, yeah, I mean, it's kind of something that you have to, as time has gone on, I'm less, it's going to sound awful, but I'm less bothered about it, you know, because there's definitely an opportunity, if you want it, to take it further and further and to push yourself into that media all the time and to be traveling back and to. And I don't want it, you know, I want to ride my bike. And when you're doing that stuff, that's not what we love, really. So I feel like there could be more, but that's not why I got into the sport. I didn't get into mountain biking to be famous or be on the telly and stuff. It's incredible for the sport, and anything we have done and anything we will do is good for the sport, you know. But I feel like there's definitely you need that drive to want that attention, I guess, and that kind of that level of. Yeah.
And it takes away time as well, right? Which is needed for training and
resting. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there's only a finite amount of time in the year, and you have to be careful what you spend that energy on. You know, you really do. And there's so many commitments and so many things that you need to do, that all the extras, you have to be careful. I was up for the Laureus Action Sportswoman, and I had admittedly never heard of the Laureus Awards before. But then massive like global sports awards, and the awards was in Monaco, but we were in California. It was like in February, and we were in California training, and they were like, we'll fly you back, like we'll fly you business and come to the awards. And I kind of knew that I was going to win it, and I was like, oh, I literally can't, because I want to train and I'll be jet lagged and blah blah blah. And I didn't go, and I missed the awards, and I didn't go, and it would have been like so cool. And then I've not been nominated since, and I was gutted, and I wish I'd gone. But every decision is based on what's better for your racing. And I didn't go, and I always regret it. But I also know that my racing benefited because of that. So yeah,
it's just another example of the sacrifice, I guess, it takes to be at the top.
Sweet party or just more training.
Cool. All right. Well, we're getting towards the end of our time. So we've got our three questions that we ask everybody, so we'll hit those up, and then maybe one or two little others. But so the first one of those, if our listeners had £150 to spend to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they spend it on?
Well, I was thinking of my answers before as I was driving here, and I would say it depends on what they think their weakness is, because there's so many things that you can do depending on what you want to improve. And I think that's pretty key, because if you're a racer, and you know, like there's a young lad that we know who's junior, and he's flat out really fast, but he sucks at actually not crashing. He crashes every time, and like he's really fast racer, but he crashes. And so he needs to work on his ability to ride under pressure. So for him, he should buy like the free lap poles or some sort of timing equipment to time himself when he's riding at home, so he gets used to that, riding under that pressure of being on the clock. Whereas if you don't race and you want to improve like your technical skills, or you just want to be a better rider, perhaps you could pay your mate £5 to actually just video you on your phone, because seeing yourself ride is a massive benefit and something that we even do at races now. You can see how your suspension's working. It highlights things that you had no idea were happening.
Okay.
You're like, oh my God, look how my shock is totally blown like through, and it's not even working, or you know, right. Like my hands are totally in the wrong position, my levers must be wrong. So that, and that's pretty much free. So,
yeah.
Or up the money and buy a GoPro, because for a racer to be able to watch that footage again and again in good quality is pretty game changing, really.
Yeah, yeah. There's plenty on eBay.
Yeah, yeah.
Wicked. All right, next one. If you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself age 16, what advice would you give her?
I don't know. Well, I always say to people, don't let your kid race because it's so gnarly. But I wouldn't say that. I guess I've said it before to other girls, like, get strong as quick as you can, because the less injuries you have, the better. You know, I wish I was stronger when I was younger.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that would have saved some crashes, or you just would have got less hurt? Or
I don't know. Maybe it would have saved some injuries and stuff. Yeah. So, yeah. And, you know, Tane is pretty strong and she has some big crashes and she seems fine from them. So that's pretty admirable.
Yeah. Yeah, fair play.
Jealous.
And the last one of these three, if you could have a coaching session with anyone, past or present, who would it be and what would you want to learn?
Anne Caro. Everything. Yeah, I mean, she's, and will always be, like, no one will get close to her ever.
Was it like 55 World Cup wins or something?
Such a legend.
Crazy.
I think, yeah, and I used to just chant her name, like, if there was a big hill climb or something on the road bike, Anne Caro. And she's, I just go all tongue-tied, and when I speak to her or see her now, it's, she's just so incredible, such a talented bike handler and such a good competitor, like, mentally strong. But yeah, she's pretty cool.
Yeah. Is there any particular element of her riding or persona that you'd want to kind of ask specifically about? She said she's mentally strong, but
I think, like, she seems pretty confident, like, in the grip of her, like, on the edge of her tires.
Okay.
And I hate that area.
That skittish
edge. Yeah. But it's probably because I ride in mud, and she's grown up in the south of France on the loose, horrible, just gravelly, like, horrible stuff that no one likes unless you live there.
Like, fast, kind of
and
loose
corners.
She's
so, like, comfortable there.
Yeah.
But you can't really, there's nothing you can say about that. You just got to practice.
Yeah, fair play. And then any advice for people that are looking to get into downhill racing and, you know, kind of inspired by your success and want to do well?
Well, I just say, ride your bike, you know. Don't worry too much about the details, you know. Just ride. Like, when you're quite young, it doesn't really matter if you're doing a 6-minute warm-up or at the race or not, or, you know, just ride and ride loads and get as much experience in every single different scenario that you can, you know, in the rain, get experience being hungry, get experience, like, breaking down on the race, just everything, because all that experience will come into play and help you at some point.
Yeah.
So just go and live and experience everything you can.
Get involved.
Yeah.
Good stuff. And last question, Dovey Bike Park.
Oh, yeah.
Is it awesome? And when do you think we might be able to ride there? Like, is it
close? It's awesome. Yeah. No, it is close. We've been trying all winter to get it open, like, ASAP. And it's literally looking like probably in the next month or 2 months.
Wicked.
Dare I say it?
Yeah.
And people are saying, oh, well, it's never going to happen. Like, it's just a private place. And it's not, you know, as soon as we can, it's open and it's a bike park. Everyone can come and ride. And it's so sick. It's so much fun. And they're all massive tracks, like, over 5 minutes every track. And it's a huge elevation and it's got all different abilities. And it's, you know, I've been training there for the last few years for the World Cups, and all the mates in the village have been riding it that can, you know, barely ride. So it's all abilities, really.
Yeah.
It's sick and ongoing. So, yeah.
Awesome.
As soon as possible.
Yeah.
But we'll definitely, you won't be able to not hear about it. You'll be sick of it.
Excellent. Yeah, good stuff. All right, nice one. And if people want to follow you over the season, where's the best place for them to keep in touch? Is it Instagram?
Yeah, probably Instagram, isn't it, these days? I don't really do anything else. We've got obviously all our personal ones, like Dan has got one, she's got one, I've got one. We've also got the Athen Racing one.
Yeah.
And the Athen Bikes one is obviously where all the bike info is going, and the Athen Bikes website,
yeah,
which will be live any second. A lot of people have been asking when are the bikes coming mm-hmm. for sale and stuff, and we're looking to launch and to bring them to market early summer, so
sweet,
probably a lot earlier than people expect. So
yeah,
trail bike and downhill bike. So
that's very cool. People can own the same bike that you guys have. Wicked.
Yeah, and they're you know, it's a bike for you. It's your bike, basically how you want it. So
yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, nice.
But yeah.
Exciting times.
Thank
all right.
You very much.
Well, thank you so much for giving us a big chunk of your afternoon.
Rambling.
All the best for the season ahead. Look, exciting. Lots of racing to go at some, well, not new venues, but venues we've not been to for a World Cup for a good while.
Yeah.
And yeah, it should
be
exciting.
Good, I think, hopefully. I'm sure it's going to be exciting.
Yeah.
Either way.
Good stuff. All right. Thanks, Rachel. Cheers
cool.
for your time.
Thank you.
All right, that's it for this week's episode. I hope you've enjoyed listening to Rachel's story. I was blown away by the drive and determination that Rachel's had throughout her career and clearly still has today. I can't wait for the first World Cup. Don't forget to follow us on social media, subscribe to the podcast so you get all of our episodes delivered straight to your device. And if you want to get yourself some exclusive Downtime Podcast goodies, then head to downtimepodcast.com/shop. All right, please keep telling your friends about the podcast and keep on spreading the word. It really, really helps, and I massively appreciate it. All right, we've got another awesome episode coming up soon, but until then, get out and ride.